Welcome to the History Maps podcast. Picture this. It is April 14, 1865. Abraham Lincoln is sitting at his desk, and he signs legislation authorizing a commission to create a highly specialized federal security force.
Right, and we know exactly how that day ends. Hours later, he goes to Ford's Theater and is assassinated.
Exactly. And if you look at that sequence of events, a really obvious question emerges. Why didn't the agency he literally greenlit that very morning stop his killer?
Well, it is because they were not designed to protect him at all. I mean, they were designed to protect his money.
Yeah, and that is what we are getting into today. Our mission for this deep dive is to explore the complete history, the evolution, and, you know, the internal structure of the United States Secret Service.
We are going to unpack how a team of essentially financial investigators hunting down forged paper currency evolved into one of the most elite physical security forces in the world.
And really balancing that dual mandate, right? Protecting the nation's financial infrastructure and simultaneously protecting its top leaders.
Yeah, to understand how an agency with absolutely no mandate to protect the president becomes the modern Secret Service, you have to look at the sheer scale of the crisis they were built to solve in the first place.
Right, because in 1865, the United States was facing what was essentially an economic collapse.
Exactly. Following the American Civil War, counterfeiting was not just a nuisance, it was a systemic threat to the survival of the nation.
How bad was it, actually?
Well, it is estimated that up to one-third of the $400 million in U.S. currency in circulation at that time was entirely fake.
One-third? I mean, if I am a merchant in 1865, that means every third customer walking into my shop is handing me a worthless piece of paper.
Yeah, pretty much.
But how did the system become so vulnerable that a third of the entire money supply was just compromised?
So the vulnerability was actually built into the system itself. Prior to the Legal Tender Act of 1862, there was no uniform federal paper money.
Meaning there was no standard dollar bill that everyone recognized.
Right. Instead of a single recognizable currency, you had over 10,000 different varieties of state and private banknotes in circulation.
Over 10,000. That sounds impossible to keep track of.
It was. Every local bank, railroad company, and sometimes even large general stores could issue their own notes. They were often called wildcat banks.
So there was no baseline at all. If someone hands me a note from a bank three states away, I have no realistic way of knowing what the engraving should look like.
Exactly. You wouldn't know what paper they use, or honestly, if that bank even existed in the first place.
It is basically an open invitation for fraud. A counterfeiter does not even need to be highly skilled at that point.
No, they really don't. They can just invent a fictitious bank, print a convincing-looking piece of paper, and, well, pass it off to a merchant who doesn't know any better.
So the federal government realized that if the public lost faith in the newly established national currency, the greenbacks they introduced during the war to fund the Union Army, the post-war economic recovery would just collapse entirely.
That is exactly the calculation they made. They needed a dedicated force to eliminate the counterfeiters. So on July 5, 1865, the Secret Service Division was officially established.
And this was housed within the Department of the Treasury in Washington, D.C., right?
Yes. The first chief was a man named William P. Wood, and he was sworn in by Treasury Secretary Hugh McCulloch.
But, you know, we are talking about 1865. There are no wiretaps, no centralized databases, no digital forensics.
Right. The tools we associate with modern investigations just do not exist.
So how does William P. Wood actually build an operation to dismantle a decentralized network of forgers across the entire country?
Well, Wood had a background as a detective and a prison warden. So he approached the problem by building a highly specialized intelligence unit that relied entirely on human networks.
He utilized deep undercover investigations from what I read.
He did. His operatives would infiltrate the criminal syndicates, basically posing as buyers of counterfeit currency.
And they built extensive informant networks, right?
Yeah, exactly. They did this by offering clemency or financial rewards to lower level criminals who were willing to turn on their bosses.
It sounds like they recognized early on that arresting the person buying a loaf of bread with a fake bill was just a waste of time. You have to go after the supply chain.
You have to target the entire manufacturing process. A successful counterfeit operation back then required highly skilled engravers to create the metal plates.
And they needed specific types of paper, specialized ink, heavy printing presses.
Right. So the Secret Service agents tracked those physical materials. If they found a supplier selling large quantities of a specific green ink, They followed that ink.
Straight to the printing press.
Exactly. They conducted coordinated raids, seizing the equipment and the plates, which essentially destroyed the means of production.
And their methods were highly effective. The documentation shows they achieved a 90% conviction rate in their early documented cases.
A 90% conviction rate is staggering for that era, especially without any modern forensic science.
And I imagine that kind of success gets noticed in Washington pretty quickly.
Right.
I mean, if you have the only competent undercover federal investigative force in the country, other departments are going to want to use them.
That is precisely how their mandate began to expand. In 1867, which is just 2 years after their founding, their responsibilities were officially broadened.
Broadened to include what, exactly?
The wording was to include detecting persons perpetrating frauds against the government. And that was a massive umbrella.
So what did they actually start investigating under that umbrella?
The Secret Service began investigating the Ku Klux Klan, illegal distillers who were avoiding the whiskey tax, smugglers, mail theft, and widespread land fraud.
Which really explains why the Treasury Department was the only logical home for this agency.
Yeah, if we look at the federal law enforcement landscape in the mid-19th century, it was incredibly sparse.
Right. You had the U.S. Postal Inspectors, the U.S. Marshals who largely served the courts, customs agents at the ports, and the park watchmen.
Exactly. There was no centralized investigative bureau like we have today.
And the Treasury Department managed the nation's revenues, so they had the most direct imperative to stop economic crimes.
It makes complete sense.
It's like the post-war counterfeiting epidemic was a virus in the nation's economic bloodstream. You know, the Treasury Department had to build a highly specialized federal immune system.
That is a good way to look at it.
And the first antibodies they deployed operated purely on human intelligence, hunting down the engravers and ink suppliers directly to eliminate the infection at the source.
And as those antibodies proved effective, the government started deploying them against other systemic infections, like organized smuggling and Doritic terrorism groups that were threatening federal authority.
Wait, but I have to push back here. If the federal government was fully capable of organizing an elite undercover force to protect printed money.
Yeah.
And they could deploy them to investigate everything from land fraud to the Ku Klux Klan. How is it possible they just left the commander-in-chief completely exposed?
It is a glaring blind spot.
I mean, Lincoln is assassinated in 1865. James A. Garfield is assassinated in 1881. Why did it take another 36 years for the Secret Service to get a protective mandate?
Well, because the concept of a dedicated protective detail clashed entirely with the political philosophy of 19th century America.
In what way?
There was a deep-seated resistance to the idea of a standing federal police force, and an even stronger resistance to anything resembling a royal guard for the president.
Because it felt too monarchical.
Exactly. The prevailing democratic ideal was that the president was a citizen, first and foremost, and therefore had to remain accessible to the public.
So providing a permanent armed security detail felt too much like a European monarchy to legislators and the public alike.
Right. So the economic bleeding is stopped, and the agency maintained its purely financial and investigative focus for decades.
And that mindset held until a third tragedy at the dawn of the 20th century forced a permanent change in their mandate.
Yes. The assassination of President William McKinley in 1901 was the catalyst that finally broke that ideological resistance.
McKinley was shaking hands in a public receiving line at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York.
He was, and he was shot by an anarchist who had concealed a revolver under a handkerchief.
After McKinley died from his wounds, Congress finally recognized that the modern presidency, in an increasingly complex and dangerous world, just required full-time institutionalized protection.
They formally requested that the Secret Service assume this duty, beginning with the incoming president, Theodore Roosevelt.
But that is a monumental shift in operations. I mean, they go from tracking down ink plates in basements and infiltrating smuggling rings to standing between the most powerful person in the country and a crowd of thousands.
It was a massive operational pivot. And it began as a somewhat informal arrangement, actually operating without a rigid statutory requirement for several years.
But the agents adapted rapidly, right? Because by 1909, we see them operating effectively on an international level.
Right, specifically during the Taft-Mexican summit.
President William Howard Taft met with Mexican President Porfirio Diaz in El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
And from the sources, this reads like an absolute security nightmare.
Two heads of state in an incredibly tense political environment, moving through open streets.
Exactly. And during the summit procession, Secret Service agents working directly alongside Mexican agents spotted a man in the crowd.
And he was holding a concealed palm pistol along the route, right?
Yes. They apprehended him silently and successfully prevented an assassination attempt before the presidents even realized what was happening.
This gets to the core of the transition for me.
Yeah.
How do agents who were originally trained to analyze paper fibers and counterfeit ink adapt their skill sets to scanning crowds, reading body language, and identifying physical threats?
It is a great question, especially since they do not have radios, they do not have earpieces, and there is no modern surveillance network at this time.
Right, they're relying entirely on themselves.
The thing is, the foundational skills of an investigator actually translate seamlessly to physical protection.
How so?
An investigator is trained to look for the anomaly, the element that breaks the pattern. If you spend years analyzing banknotes, you train your eye to catch the one microscopic flaw in the engraving that proves it is a forgery.
Okay, I see.
When you put that same agent in a crowd, they are looking for the behavioral forgery.
The behavioral forgery. I like that term.
They scan for the individual whose behavior, gaze, or posture deviates from everyone else around them.
So while 10,000 people are looking at the president's carriage, cheering, the agent is looking for the one person whose eyes are locked on the security personnel, or whose hand is fixed inside their coat.
Precisely. They were establishing a physical perimeter through sheer situational awareness and advanced human psychology.
And the infrastructure around presidential security continued to grow to support that human intelligence as the century progressed.
It did. In 1922, President Warren G. Harding created the White House Police Force.
And this was initially created to provide dedicated security for the executive residence itself, right? Focusing on the physical grounds rather than traveling with the president.
Yes, that was its initial scope. But by 1930, this force was fully integrated into the Secret Service.
So it provided a fixed-site security apparatus that eventually evolved into what we now know as the Uniform Division.
Exactly. But it is important to note that even with this new, highly visible protective role, they never dropped the financial investigations.
Right. In fact, the sources outline a very specific, almost bizarre statutory requirement during this era involving gold coins.
You are referring to the 1933 Double Eagle gold coin.
Yeah. What is the story there?
The Secret Service is specifically tasked with investigating reports of these coins because they were never officially issued for circulation.
Due to changes in the gold standard policy, right?
Correct. Almost all of them were ordered melted down. Owning one, with the exception of a single authorized specimen, is illegal.
So tracking down these rare pieces of currency actually remains part of their mandate.
It does. It is a perfect example of how they were balancing these two entirely different worlds for decades.
They operated with a relatively stable set of protocols for a long time. They relied on proximity, human intelligence, and local law enforcement cooperation.
That is, until the events of a single afternoon in Dallas completely upended their understanding of presidential security.
The assassination of President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963.
That event fundamentally shattered the existing security paradigm.
When you review the historical footage from Dallas, the security posture looks completely alien compared to what we see today.
It really does.
The president is in an open-top limousine, moving slowly through a dense urban environment with high-rise buildings on all sides.
And the agents are standing on the running boards, the follow-up car, basically entirely reactive to whatever might happen.
Following the assassination, the Warren Commission conducted an exhaustive investigation.
And their findings highlighted severe coordination gaps between the Secret Service and the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
So threat intelligence regarding individuals in the Dallas area was not being shared effectively between the agencies.
Exactly. Furthermore, the commission recognized that the Secret Service was significantly understaffed and entirely under-resourced for the modern threat landscape.
A landscape which now clearly included long-range ballistics. Dallas proved that the threat was not just physical proximity anymore. It was systemic.
Right. The agency realized they were not just protecting a man. They had to protect the entire apparatus of government.
Which meant their personnel numbers and their legal boundaries had to expand practically overnight.
The immediate result was a massive personnel expansion. The agency grew from roughly 500 agents to over 1,000 in a very short period.
And the legislative framework for protection was expanded rapidly to ensure continuity of government on multiple fronts.
In 1965, Congress authorized lifetime protection for former presidents and their spouses.
as well as protection for their children until the age of 16.
Yes. And then 1968 forces another major expansion.
This was a deeply tragic year, marked by the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr.
The violence was targeting the political process itself, not just the sitting office holders.
In response, Congress authorized protection for major presidential and vice presidential candidates and nominees.
So now the Secret Service is not just protecting the current administration, but the potential future administrations months before an election even happens.
The logistical burden of moving that many protected individuals across the country continuously is immense.
The mandate just continued to grow. In 1971, protection was extended to visiting foreign heads of state.
To manage this massive increase in operational tempo, the agency had to modernize its workforce, which also meant significant internal milestones regarding diversity.
Absolutely. If you are expanding a force that quickly, you need to broaden your recruitment pool.
In 1970, Phyllis Schantz became the first female officer sworn into the Uniform Division,
which was then called the Executive Protective Service.
Right. The following year, in 1971, the first five official female special agents were sworn in.
Their names were Lori Anderson, Sue Baker, Catherine Clark, Holly Huffschmidt, and Phyllis Schantz, who transitioned from the Uniform Division to become a special agent.
Alongside these personnel changes, the tactical modernization during this period was intense.
The shift was moving entirely from reactive protection to proactive intelligence and specialized tactical response.
They began building dedicated units to address specific threat vectors, didn't they?
Yes. In 1971, the agency formed the Counter Sniper Team. And in 1979, they established the Counter Assault Team, widely known as CAT.
If we look at this era of the Secret Service, it really mirrors the evolution of early aviation.
How so?
The rules and protocols of flight were essentially written in the aftermath of crashes. Every new threat, every failure, dictated a new specialized unit or a new protocol.
That is a very accurate comparison.
I mean, they did not build the Counter Sniper Team until they realized long-range overwatch was necessary, which is a direct lesson from the Texas School Book Depository.
And the development of the Counter Assault Team was another direct lesson in modern warfare tactics.
Because the close protection detail, the agents in suits standing immediately next to the president, are not designed to fight a protracted gun battle.
No, their sole job is to cover the protectee and evacuate. CCAT was developed to provide overwhelming, specialized suppressive firepower.
So if an organized close quarters ambush occurs, CCAT deploys heavily armed operators to engage and neutralize the threat.
Exactly. They lay down a wall of fire so the primary detail has the seconds they need to get the president out of the kill zone.
We see the mechanics of that exact evacuation training put to the test on March 30, 1981.
President Ronald Reagan is leaving the Washington Hilton Hotel.
He is walking toward his limousine when John Hinckley Jr. opens fire with a revolver from the press line.
In the span of a few seconds, the Secret Service protocols execute exactly as designed under extreme stress.
The close protection agents immediately force the president into the armored vehicle.
It is a chaotic scene, but when you break down the biomechanics of the agent's movements, it goes against every human survival instinct.
Specifically, the actions of Agent Timothy McCarthy.
Agent McCarthy's actions perfectly illustrate the core psychological rewiring of the Secret Service detail.
Because when the shots rang out, human instinct dictates seeking cover or dropping to the ground, fright.
But McCarthy did the opposite. He turned toward the sound of the gunfire, stepped in front of the president, and spread his stance.
He executed the training doctrine of making himself as large as you can.
He intentionally expanded his physical profile to create a human shield, locking the angle between the shooter and the president.
And he took a bullet directly to the chest.
He survived the wound, but that instinct, trained deep into muscle memory, is what separates protective work from traditional law enforcement.
You are not trying to arrest the shooter in that moment. Your primary, singular objective is the physical shielding and evacuation of the principal.
Even at the cost of your own life.
The threats continued to evolve throughout the 90s, shifting from lone gunmen to mass casualty terrorism.
In 1995, a domestic terrorist detonates a massive truck bomb outside the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City.
And the Secret Service actually had a field office inside that building.
Yes. Six Secret Service personnel were killed in the blast.
The bombing forced a massive reevaluation of physical security perimeters for all federal buildings, but especially the White House.
The blast demonstrated that you no longer needed line of sight to kill a target. You just needed proximity with a large enough explosive yield.
This led directly to the closure of Pennsylvania Avenue near the White House to vehicular traffic, right?
It did. The concept of standoff distance became a paramount concern for the agency.
Standoff distance being the physical space between a potential explosive threat and the target structure.
Exactly. By closing the street, they pushed the perimeter back, ensuring that even if a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device detonated, the energy of the blast would dissipate before it could compromise the structural integrity of the executive residence.
This era of adapting to complex, large-scale threats culminated in the year 2000 Presidential Threat Protection Act,
which formalized the concept of National Special Security Events, or NSSEs.
What qualifies as an NSSE?
An NSSE is a major federal or international event considered a highly attractive target for terrorism or other criminal activity.
Like the Super Bowl or a political convention.
Right, or the State of the Union address. When an event receives this designation, the Secret Service is legally mandated to serve as the lead agency for the design and implementation of the operational security plan.
So they coordinate intelligence, airspace restrictions, and physical perimeters across dozens of local, state, and federal agencies.
They run the whole show.
So, just as the agency mastered the Cold War landscape of lone gunmen and domestic unrest, the dawn of the 21st century introduced asymmetric global terrorism and digital crime.
Which brings us to the biggest structural shift in the agency's history.
September 11, 2001. It fundamentally altered the architecture of the United States government.
For the Secret Service, the immediate response on that morning involved the emergency evacuation of Vice President Dick Cheney and the securing of all protectees amid a completely unprecedented, multi-pronged attack on the homeland.
But the legislative changes that followed are what completely reshaped the agency.
Yes. In October 2001, the USA Patriot Act is signed into law.
And the Patriot Act explicitly authorized the Secret Service to establish electronic crimes task forces.
This was a statutory recognition that the threat to the financial system was no longer just printing presses in a basement.
The threat was networked, it was digital, and it was global.
Counterfeiters were replaced by hackers breaching international banking mainframes.
And then comes the Homeland Security Act of 2002.
This legislation created the Department of Homeland Security, taking 22 disparate federal agencies and consolidating them under one massive umbrella.
So on March 1, 2003, the Secret Service was officially transferred from the Department of the Treasury,
which had been its home for 138 years.
And they were moved to the newly formed Department of Homeland Security.
Let us dive into the friction of that transfer for a second.
There was definitely friction.
Because moving an agency with a century and a half of history, deeply rooted in the culture of the Treasury Department, into a massive new bureaucracy focused entirely on counterterrorism had to cause significant internal and political tension.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you are a financial crimes investigator who has spent your career tracking bank fraud, suddenly you're sitting in meetings about global counterterrorism strategy.
There was intense debate in congressional oversight committees about this transfer, right?
Yes. The primary criticism was that placing the Secret Service under a massive counterterrorism umbrella might subordinate its highly specialized financial crime expertise.
Critics argued that the financial investigative mission, which had always been the foundation of the agency's skill set, might be starved of resources, budget, and focus in favor of the broader Homeland Security and physical protection mandate.
Despite the transfer, they maintain their authority over financial crimes, and the scope of those crimes in the modern era is staggering.
We are talking about combating ransomware, digital currency fraud, complex credit card fraud, and major network breaches.
The scale is entirely different from the 1860s. Consider Operation Firewall in 2004.
What happened there?
The Secret Service led a multinational investigation into global cybercrime networks. This operation resulted in 28 arrests and the seizure of $30 million in counterfeit currency in a single raid.
They were tracking transnational organized crime syndicates operating in the digital space across multiple continents.
It was a massive undertaking.
Here's where I have to ask about the reality of the dual objective philosophy. We have an agency that is running multinational task forces to track down digital currency fraud on decentralized ledgers.
Right.
And simultaneously trying to secure the physical perimeter of a presidential motorcade moving through a major city. Do the skills used to track a global cyber fraud ring actually translate to physical protection anymore? or does the agency suffer from a split personality?
The agency maintains that the missions absolutely synergize, and it goes deeper than just organizational habit.
How so?
The investigative work requires agents to develop complex networks of informants, understand global financial flows, and utilize cutting-edge surveillance technology.
Great.
When those agents rotate onto a protective detail, they bring a deep understanding of how criminal networks organize, communicate, and fund themselves.
So the argument is that the analytical mindset required to dismantle a cyber syndicate is directly applied to analyzing threat intelligence.
Exactly. If you can track a hidden offshore bank account through layers of shell companies, you train your brain to spot the logistical vulnerabilities in a physical security plan before an adversary can exploit them.
So the investigative foundation builds a better, more analytical protective agent.
That is the philosophy. However, the expansion of responsibilities combating global cybercrime while managing an ever-growing list of protectees and NSSEs created intense logistical strain.
And that strain leads us into a modern era marked by highly publicized security lapses. Now, as we look at the events of the last decade, specifically January 6th, 2021, and the July 2024 Butler rally, we are stepping into incredibly charged territory.
We are.
But for our purposes today, we are taking the politics entirely off the table. We are strictly examining the blueprints, the operational facts, the security perimeters, and the structural failures as documented in the official audits and inspector general reports.
Let us look at the operational strain that became highly visible in 2014. On September 19, a man named Omar Gonzalez jumped the fence at the White House.
Fence jumpers are not entirely uncommon given the location, but this incident was profoundly different, wasn't it?
It was, because Gonzalez was not stopped on the lawn. He made it entirely across the grounds and into the White House itself, entering the East Room through an unlocked door.
A completely unlocked door at the executive residence. That implies a massive breakdown in layers of security.
The failure was indeed multi-layered. The perimeter alarms that should have alerted the detail were muted because they were deemed too noisy by the staff.
Muted because they were noisy. That is hard to believe.
And the canine units trained to intercept intruders on the lawn were not properly deployed. Finally, the physical security checks of the doors failed completely.
It exposed severe gaps in the uniform division's protocols and led to the resignation of the agency's director at the time. It was a clear indicator of systemic fatigue.
Fast forward to the events surrounding January 6, 2021. Again, focusing strictly on the agency's operational role based on the documentation.
Right. What did the documentation show?
The documentation shows that the Secret Service possessed intelligence regarding violent threats and forwarded warnings to the Capitol Police the day prior to the events.
And on the day itself, as the perimeter of the Capitol was breached by the crowd, the Secret Service detail was responsible for the physical evacuation of Vice President Mike Pence.
They moved him to a secure underground location within the complex and refused to let him leave the grounds in a vehicle, strictly adhering to continuity of government protocols.
But the operational scrutiny came after the fact, specifically regarding the retention of communications during a crisis.
Yes. Following the events, oversight officials and congressional committees requested the text messages of Secret Service agents from that day to understand the flow of intelligence and operational decisions.
And the agency stated that the messages had been deleted as part of a pre-planned agency-wide phone migration program.
This resulted in significant controversy and extensive inspector general reviews regarding the agency's data retention policies, digital infrastructure, and accountability mechanisms.
Which brings us to the most severe operational failure in recent history. July 13, 2024. The assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania. Let us walk through the specific mechanics of what occurred.
The former president was speaking at an open-air campaign rally. A shooter gained access to the roof of a building located outside the immediate secured perimeter controlled by the Secret Service, but the roof had a direct line of sight to the stage.
The shooter opened fire. Trump's ear was pierced by a bullet.
An attendee, Corey Comprator, was killed and others were critically injured. Within seconds of the first shots, the Secret Service counter-sniper team, maintaining overwatch, engaged and neutralized the shooter.
Simultaneously, the close protection detail swarmed the former president, physically covering him and executing a rapid evacuation to the armored motorcade.
The immediate fallout was seismic. You had a House hearing where the director of the Secret Service, Kimberly Cheadle, faced intense bipartisan calls for her resignation over the perimeter failure.
She resigned on July 23, 2024, just 10 days after the shooting. Sean Curran was subsequently appointed to lead the agency and implement structural reforms.
When you unpack the findings of the Congressional and Inspector General reviews that followed Butler, they draw a very sharp line between two distinct elements of the day.
They clearly differentiate between individual bravery and systemic failure.
Right, they do. The agents on the stage executed their training flawlessly. They covered the protectee without hesitation, shielding him with their bodies. The counter-sniper team neutralized the threat rapidly under extreme pressure.
But the audits focus on the systemic logistical failures that allowed the threat to materialize in the first place.
Exactly. So if a shooter gets a clear line of sight from a roof just outside the perimeter, that implies a massive breakdown in the advance work.
What were the specific systemic failures identified?
The audits identified poor perimeter protocols, specifically the decision to leave a building with a clear line of sight outside the hard perimeter without securing its access points.
So there was unmonitored roof access?
Crucially, there were severe communication breakdowns between the Secret Service and the local law enforcement agencies tasked with securing that outer perimeter.
The reviews pointed to a failure to integrate radio channels and share real-time intelligence, didn't they?
Yes, as the suspect was spotted by local officers prior to the shooting, but that information did not reach the Secret Service detail in time.
The audits also highlight broader, deeply rooted issues within the agency. Severe resource drain, bureaucratic inefficiencies, and what was described in the reports as corrosive cultural attitudes.
The term corrosive culture in these audits often refers to a mindset of complacency or an over-reliance on local law enforcement partners without proper oversight or integrated command structures.
This culture is heavily driven by the intense fatigue of managing constantly expanding mandates with limited manpower and resources. Wait, but if they have the funding to deploy counter-sniper teams and run global cyber task forces, is this really just a funding or personnel issue?
Well, that is the big question.
When you look at the sheer scope of what this agency is asked to do, from dismantling ransomware syndicates in Eastern Europe to securing open-air political rallies in rural Pennsylvania, could it be that the mandate itself has become too sprawling for any single agency to execute flawlessly?
That is the core debate occurring in oversight committees right now. Some lawmakers and security experts argue the agency simply needs a massive influx of funding, better retention incentives to combat burnout, and modernize technology.
While others argue the mission itself is fundamentally overextended.
Exactly. They argue no amount of funding can fix a structural flaw where an agency is stretched across two entirely different domains of security.
To really understand how these systemic pressures affect the people on the ground, we have to look at how the modern Secret Service is organized. How does an individual actually build a career within this high-stakes, high-burnout environment?
A special agent's career is typically structured in three distinct phases, designed to build their skills progressively.
What is phase one?
Phase one is the entry phase. New agents are assigned to one of the field offices. The agency maintains 116 domestic offices and 20 overseas offices.
And when they arrive at a field office, they are not immediately standing next to the president.
Far from it. They are focusing almost entirely on financial crimes and cyber investigations. This is where they build those foundational investigative skills we discussed earlier.
They spend years interviewing suspects, analyzing financial data, writing search warrants, and working with federal prosecutors to build complex cases.
It is exactly like a medical residency. You're forcing every prospective surgeon to spend years doing foundational lab work, running basic diagnostics, and understanding the anatomy of financial crimes before they are ever allowed to step into the emergency room of presidential protection.
That is the exact design of the career path. They want agents who have proven their analytical capability, their patience, and their attention to detail in the field before they entrust them with a physical detail.
So they have done the gritty financial lab work. They have proven they can spot anomalies. They move to phase two.
Phase two is the protective reassignment.
Yes. Agents are moved to protective details for a period of 3 to 5 years. But it is important to distinguish between the different types of details as they carry different levels of prestige and resources.
Because securing a sitting president is vastly different from securing a visiting dignitary.
Precisely. The Presidential Protective Division, or PPD, is the most highly resourced elite division within the agency. It secures the sitting president and their immediate family.
But agents might also be assigned to the details for former presidents, major political candidates, or foreign heads of state.
Seniority, performance in the field, and experience heavily dictate who gets placed in the PPD.
I have to imagine burnout is incredibly high at the end of that 3 to 5 year protective rotation.
Yeah.
The travel, the stress, the constant vigilance. Where do they even go from there? Phase three.
Phase three is post-protective. Agents rotate off the grueling travel schedule of the details. They return to the field offices, take on leadership and management roles at headquarters, or join highly specialized operational units where their experience is invaluable.
But the special agents in the suits are only one part of the equation. We have to talk about the uniform division, the UD, who are arguably the most visible part of the agency in Washington.
The uniform division operates with police ranks, officers, sergeants, lieutenants, rather than agent ranks. They are tasked exclusively with fixed site protection.
They secure the physical grounds and perimeters of the White House complex, the Vice President's residence at the Naval Observatory, and foreign diplomatic missions in the Washington, D.C. area.
They provide the highly visible tactical perimeter defense that deters threats before they reach the inner circle.
And then you have the Special Operations Division, the SOD, which houses the tactical units we mentioned earlier. This is where the specialized firepower and response capabilities live.
Mm-hmm. The SOD is where you find the most specialized, technically proficient capabilities. You have the counter sniper team, providing long-range overwatch and ballistics intelligence.
You have the emergency response team, the ERT, which is the tactical unit designed for close quarters breach and response on the White House grounds.
There is the canine explosive detection unit, sweeping vehicles and venues. And then you have the HAMMER team.
HAMMER stands for Hazardous Agent Mitigation Medical Emergency Response.
They're equipped to handle chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear threats.
So if a protectee is exposed to a hazardous substance, the HAMMER team provides immediate triage, medical intervention, and decontamination during a high-speed protective movement.
The training required to maintain proficiency across all these disciplines is rigorous, and the compensation reflects the extreme demands of the job.
Agents can earn up to $228,000 per year, which includes a specific pay structure called LE.
LEP stands for Law Enforcement Availability Pay, because the nature of the job requires them to work intense, unpredictable hours, often traveling globally on a moment's notice and working entirely outside a standard 40-hour week. This pay structure compensates them for being constantly available to the agency.
And they recently modernized their standard issue equipment as well, transitioning to the 9mm Glock 19 Gen 5 pistol.
The equipment modernization is constant, reflecting the need for absolute reliability, increased magazine capacity, and standardization across the force.
But underneath all the tactical gear, the complex pay scale, and the advanced weaponry, there is a complex hierarchical culture within the agency.
How does that culture manifest day to day?
There is a distinct cultural dynamic and sometimes friction between the investigative agents working cybercrimes in the field offices, the protective agents on the high-profile details, and the uniformed division officers manning the security gates.
Navigating that internal culture where prestige and promotion are often tied to proximity to the president and high-profile protective assignments is a major part of building a career in the Secret Service.
When you look at the entirety of this history, it is a massive evolution. We started in 1865. With a small bureau in the Treasury Department, relying on informants to hunt down counterfeiters printing fake greenbacks.
Today, we are looking at a 21st century global security apparatus dealing with international cyber warfare, autonomous drones, and asymmetric terrorist threats.
The dual mission investigating complex financial crimes and protecting national leaders has defined their unique skill set for over a century.
It gives them an analytical edge that few security forces possess, but it also creates the modern logistical struggles and the intense resource strains we see documented today.
Which leaves us with a final question to mull over. As digital currency becomes even more abstract, operating on decentralized ledgers, and as physical threats become infinitely more sophisticated through drones and cyber warfare, will the historical marriage of financial investigation and physical protection continue to make sense?
Or is the Secret Service destined to eventually split into two entirely distinct agencies, one focused on the economy and one focused entirely on the physical continuity of the government?
It is a profound structural question. And given the escalating complexity of both domains, history will eventually force us to answer it.
It certainly will.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.